Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com, also alexlinder.com. Today we're going to do Part 3, Chapter 15 of Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones of culturewars.com, book published in 2000 out of South Bend, where Jones operates. And this again is a short chapter, as the rest of them will be through this last 80 pages or so. Part 3, Chapter 15, Notre Dame, Indiana, 1970. In June 1970, the Reverend Theodore M. Hesburgh, CSC, President of the University of Notre Dame, received the American Association of University Professors Alexander Michael John Award for his, quote, outstanding contribution to the cause of academic freedom. Hesburgh was the first Catholic ever to receive the award, and the AAUP went out of its way to explain that this fact was not some fortuitous afterthought in its deliberations. Hesburgh was being rewarded for defending the integrity of the Catholic University against the predations of the Catholic Church. Hesburgh received the award because he believed, as he had stated in the Land O'Lakes statement 3 years before, that a Catholic university must have true autonomy and academic freedom in the face of authority of whatever kind, lay or clerical, external to the academic community itself. Lest there be any doubt about which authority might prove most threatening at Notre Dame, the AAUP cited Notre Dame's stance in the wake of Humanae Vitae, the 1968 encyclical of Pope Paul VI, which labeled contraception immoral. Remember, so we've heard in earlier chapters, he's had Rockefeller and his foundations working on him, giving them grant money to hold conferences and such, and basically Hesburgh sold out the Catholic position on birth control, is what it is. Hesburgh was praised because, quote, external ecclesiastical controls at some other Catholic universities have not been permitted at Notre Dame. The sentiments were edifying if one shared the ideological view which spawned them, but they were deceptive as well. Hesburgh, after all, did claim to be defending the Catholic University against, quote, authority of whatever kind, but in practice, and the AAUP award makes this clear, the main defense was against the meddling of the Catholic Church, specifically the Curia in Rome. Hesburgh makes this fairly explicit in his autobiography, God, Country, and Notre Dame, where he dedicates an entire chapter to the topic of academic freedom. In 1954, he writes, we had a classic confrontation over the issue of academic freedom, with Notre Dame on one side and the Vatican on the other. In this confrontation, Father Hesburgh sided with the liberal American Jesuit John Courtney Murray, against every liberal Catholic's favorite villain since the time of Vatican II, Alfredo Cardinal Ottaviani. In this Enlightenment morality play, the forces of American light and progress triumph over the forces of Italian darkness and dogma. It was a bit like a Henry James plot as told by a less refined mind. Reading Hesburgh's autobiography, one comes quickly to the conclusion that this American progressive versus Roman authoritarian paradigm was not only representative, it was normative. It was exhaustive. Quote, authority of any kind was Hesburgh's way of saying the Vatican. As long as he could define the struggle in those terms, he would look good to everyone but people in the Curia. Certainly he was looking good to the people at the AAUP in 1970, but casting the conflict in those terms tells in effect only half the story. Rome was hardly the most serious threat to academic freedom at the time. Curious by its absence from Hesburgh's largely self-serving account of himself as a defender of academic freedom is any mention of the role which foundations played at Notre Dame at the time. One gets the impression that the only people who threatened academic freedom were aging clerics like Cardinal Ottaviani, or that the progressive types who staffed places like the Ford, Rockefeller, and Carnegie foundations at the time were completely disinterested when it came to how their money was to be spent. In many respects, Notre Dame's attitude toward academic freedom was a one-way street. It blocked traffic from Rome as a way of expediting commerce with New York and Washington, homes of the foundations and the Supreme Court, respectively. Hesburgh's position looks plausible as a defense of academic freedom only when he gets to present the evidence. Notre Dame's attitude toward the showing of Martin Scorsese's film, The Last Temptation of Christ, on campus in 1989, is a good indication of this double standard in action. When a number of people, professors and students alike, claim that the film was blasphemous and that a Catholic university had no business exposing undergraduates to scenes of Jesus Christ and Mary Magdalene having sexual intercourse, Hesburgh's successor, Reverend Edward Malloy, CSC, wrote to the effect, quote, "The movie, The Last Temptation of Christ, is but one of a wide range of films to be shown on campus this year. I am confident that those who choose to view it will have plenty of opportunity for discussion and analysis, including from a Christian perspective. The message is clear. Some people might consider this sort of thing disrespectful of the person of Jesus Christ, but academic freedom prevails at Notre Dame, even when it involves highly offensive portrayals of Christ's non-existent sex life." The undergraduates at Notre Dame duly absorbed the message that they were to be scrupulously tolerant when it came to matters venereal, even if they involved aspersions cast on their Lord and Savior. Quote, "So what Jesus did in his private life is totally up to him," one sophomore opined at the time. 25 years earlier, however, when Notre Dame was run by the man destined to receive the Michael John Academic Freedom Award, the university had a different attitude toward films and censorship. In December 1964, the University of Notre Dame, with President Theodore M. Hesburgh co-signing as a plaintiff, filed suit in New York Supreme Court, seeking to enjoin 20th Century Fox from releasing John Goldfarb, Please Come Home, a film starring Shirley MacLaine, which revolves around the complications which arise when a rich Arab purchases the Notre Dame football team. Hesburgh claimed that the film was guilty of, quote, "knowingly exploiting for private benefit the high prestige and good name of the university, without consent and over its objections." Father Hesburgh went on to claim that distribution of the film would cause irreparable damage to Notre Dame. If Notre Dame's willingness to haul people into court is any indication of what it holds sacred, then it is clear that the person of Jesus Christ finishes a distant second to Notre Dame's football team. It is also clear that academic freedom at Notre Dame suffered from the same double standard in its application. When it came to, quote, "authority of whatever kind, external to the university itself, there were no enemies to the left. The only threat came from the Vatican." On September 30th, 1970, 3 months after Father Hesburgh received his award for defending academic freedom, the Commission on Obscenity and Pornography, founded by H.R. 2525 3 years earlier, issued its report to the press. What would eventually come to be known as the Lockhart Commission had been called into existence 3 years earlier, largely over concern about the flood of obscene material which the Roth decision had unleashed 9 years before. On April 20th, 1967, hearings were held in Washington on H.R. 2525, a bill creating a commission to be known as the Commission on Obscenity and Pornography. Representative Dominic V. Daniels of New Jersey, who presided over the meeting, decried, quote, "the inexorable flow of noxious, hardcore pornography that continues to fill our newsstands, pour unsolicited into our homes, and threatens to contaminate young and impressionable minds." One of the main purposes of the commission was, quote, "to study the effect of obscenity and pornography upon the public, and particularly minors, and its relationship to crime and other antisocial behavior." Members of Congress had been feeling the heat from their constituents, especially about obscene materials coming unsolicited through the mails as the 60s were plunging toward a chaotic close. Previously agreed upon taboos were being broken regularly in underground newspapers and on the stage. In the Roth case, the Supreme Court stated that obscenity was not speech protected by the First Amendment. However, the justices established a formula for ascertaining obscenity that was to prove virtually impossible to apply. Quote, "whether to the average person applying contemporary community standards, the dominant theme of the material taken as a whole appeals to prurient interests." Later, the court further weakened its own formula by saying that the community in question was the entire country and not some definable geographical entity like a county or congressional district. The result of the Supreme Court's uncertain trumpet was a veritable flood of obscene materials being let loose through the mails and the virtual occupation of whole sections of certain cities by the forces of vice for a profit. The burden of dealing with the first wave of the assault fell upon the shoulders of the politicians. I suspect, testified Senator Carl Mundt of South Dakota, that half of my mail comes from mothers who are frantic because mail pours into their home and there is no way to stop it. I have a feeling that those who raise the plaintive cry of censorship do it for purposes other than to guarantee constitutional rights. I hope you disregard these arguments. It is the false shield placed in front of people who refuse to come out and argue for filth on its own merits. They try to hide behind those noble arguments as they go down in the mire and continue to try to enhance and increase juvenile delinquency in this country. The crucial issue, then as now, is the effects of pornography on those for whom it is not intended. Mundt refers to those, quote, who say this has no appeal to normal people, and abnormal people have a perfect right to get through the mail what they want, but they send it to the normal children of normal families all over this country without any request from these families to change normal human beings into abnormal people. It's a little bit hard to understand what he's talking about. I'm not sure what exactly they're mailing through the mail that's so horrifying. It was clear that no one was going to come out, again, before the internet, before the VCR. TV is just a few channels. Cable's not that widespread. So the way to do pornography is printed. It was clear that no one was going to come out and testify for the benefits of pornography, not yet anyway. But the job of controlling it was made more difficult by the hesitations of both liberals and conservatives. Lawrence Spicer, director of the Washington Office of the American Civil Liberties Union, called for scientific studies, quote, to determine if there is a causal relationship between the reading and the viewing of noxious printed or pictured material and the commission of crimes or other antisocial acts. Up until the point when it became clear that Congress was going to establish the commission no matter what the ACLU thought, the ACLU opposed the very idea of a commission at all. Bowing to the inevitable, Spicer sought to direct it along a path congenial to ACLU interests. Yeah, the way the Jews would handle Trump. They don't want him elected, but once he is, they try to guide him their way. So it was with the ACLU and the Pornography Commission. A tactic that was proved much more successful by demanding that they follow scientific criteria. Quote, while scientific study is needed, Spicer opined, anything less than it is to be feared. Just what scientific meant would become clear when the entire Lockhart Commission showed up at the Kinsey Institute for instruction in matters sexual. And you would know from earlier segments that Kinsey recorded everybody's sex history and took money from foundations to supposedly scientifically study sex. But actually, he was doing such things as paying a pedophile to molest kids on camera. The bankruptcy of contemporary conservatism was made readily apparent in the testimony of columnist James J. Kilpatrick, then editor of the Richmond Newsleader and author of a nationally syndicated column in the Washington Evening Star. He was an old paleocon for a lot of years. Put on my choice between dirt and censorship, I would opt for the dirt, Kilpatrick told the committee. The dirt at least can be seen and I can avoid it or sweep it up or paint over it or accept it as one of the smelly irritants of a free society. But you cannot always see censorship in action. You may know of its silent exercise. Those of us who believe in a free society, and all of us are committed to it, ought to believe in a society that is free for ideas that are offensive to us. Kilpatrick eventually came down for laws against obscenity, but they were so qualified by moral and intellectual agnosticism as to be all but worthless suggestions. Conservatism at this point in the country's history meant libertarianism, which meant basically hands-off what was considered private behavior. It would take another decade and a half of bitter experience before people would realize that pornography is anything but private behavior. It was first of all big business, and secondly a prime source of antisocial activity. As they used to say when I wrote, and I've mentioned this before, porn tends to be the killer app with new technology because people want sex so much that if it offers them a new way of accessing it virtually or whatever, on film, on CDs, or whatever, pornography is usually the first application that makes a lot of money, kind of leads the way. Having gone to school at the Kinsey Institute, the commission found that, quote, there are no great fortunes to be made in the stag film production. How funny is that? Pornography was a $500 million industry then, And by the time the Mies Commission decided to undo the let damage the Lockhart Commission had wrought, it grossed around $8 billion a year. In addition, the Lockhart Commission concluded that, quote, patterns of sexual behavior were to be found very stable and not altered substantially by exposure to erotica, and that, quote, exposure to erotica had no impact upon moral character. Based on its analysis of sex crimes in Denmark, the Lockhart Commission concluded that, quote, the increased availability of explicit sexual materials has been accompanied by a decrease in the incidence of sexual crime. And back then, before the internet and all that, a lot of pornography used to come actually out of the Eastern Bloc, like East Germany, but also Sweden, Denmark, and places like that. Some of the main sources. In conclusion, the Lockhart Commission decided that there was, quote, no evidence to date that exposure to explicit sexual materials plays a significant role in the causation of delinquent or criminal behavior among youth or adults. The commission cannot conclude that exposure to erotic materials is a factor in the causation of sex crime or sex delinquency. What began as a mandate from Congress to curtail pornography ended up as a soapbox from which the porn industry to proclaim libertarian cliches and anti-family propaganda evolved into, I guess. So they were going to curtail it, but they ended up more or less resorting to libertarian cliches and anti-family propaganda. Pornography was, in fact, good for you. The use of pictorial depiction of explicit sexual activity with discussion, the commission opined, provides not only information, but also a reduction of inhibition and embarrassment in talking about sex. Citizen action groups, however, can seriously interfere with the availability of legitimate materials in a community by generating an overly regressive atmosphere and by using harassment in seeking to implement their goals. As a result of their investigation, the Lockhart Commission recommended, quote, the repeal of existing federal legislation which prohibits or interferes with consensual distribution of obscene, their quotes, materials to adults. Two members of the commission, Otto N. Larson and Marvin E. Wolfgang, recommended that no restrictions be placed on the circulation of obscene materials to juveniles. There is no substantial evidence, they wrote in their minority report, that exposure to juveniles is necessarily harmful. There may even be beneficial effects. The most vehement reaction to the report's conclusions came from within the commission itself. Reverend Morton A. Hill and Winfrey C. Link issued a minority report blasting the majority document as a Magna Carta for the pornographers. They accused the report of being, quote, slanted and biased in favor of protecting the business of pornography, which the commission was mandated by the Congress to regulate. Hill and Link then went on to show that commission chairman William B. Lockhart, appointed by then-President Johnson in direct contradiction to the guidelines established by Congress, and the general counsel appointed by Lockhart, Paul Bender, had long been members of the ACLU and had used the $2 million appropriated for the commission by Congress to guarantee that the findings of the commission would coincide with ACLU policy on pornography. This meant completely ignoring evidence from law enforcement officials and manipulating whatever scientific evidence was then available in order to come up with a no-harm conclusion. Running his own parallel investigation at his own expense, Hill came up with enough evidence on the harm of pornography to make his minority report the only really convincing document in the entire report. Eventually, it was the Hill-Link minority findings which were accepted by Congress and not the majority report, but by the time the report had made the news, the damage had already been done. Unlike the majority report, the minority report allowed the testimony of law enforcement officials. Herbert W. Case, a former inspector for the Detroit Police Department, said, quote, there has not been a sex murder in the history of our department in which the killer was not an avid reader of lewd magazines. Detective Lieutenant Austin B. Duke of the St. Louis County Police Department reported, I have never picked up a juvenile sex offender who didn't have this stuff with him, in his car or in his house. The Hill-Link findings were far from just anecdotal. Even without the, quote, benefit of 15 years inundation of hardcore pornography, the legacy of the Lockhart Commission, there was ample evidence that pornography did in fact cause deviant behavior. The proper study, PROPPER, paid for by the commission itself, revealed, quote, among younger age boys, a very high relationship between A, the age at which they first saw a picture of sexual intercourse, and B, the age at which they first engaged personally in sexual intercourse. Now, that's why they want to get what they call, deliberately, wrongly, sex education in the schools, is sex exposure, because they know that the exposure to this stuff, the earlier, the more it takes the bloom off the person and jades them and gets them into the whole whirlwind that is sexual activity. You see? Gets them in, it gets them adapted, or not inoculated, but it gets them accustomed to the whole consumerist, drink, fuck, joke, be a clown, call your genitals junk. It gets that whole mentality going at a very early age. That's why they're continually giving them so-called sex education all through the middle years in school when they're young. So again, the proper study, paid for by the commission itself, revealed among younger age boys a very high relationship between A, the age at which they saw a picture of sexual intercourse, and B, the age at which they first engaged personally in sexual intercourse. Proper, in his study of 476 reformatory inmates, noted again and again a relationship between high exposure to pornography and sexually promiscuous and deviant behavior at very early ages, as well as affiliation with groups high in criminal activity and sex deviancy. Citing a study by Davis and Brout, Hill found that exposure to pornography was, quote, the strongest predictor of sexual deviance among the early age of exposure subjects. In general, then, exposure to pornography in the early age subgroup was related to a variety of precocious, heterosexual, and deviant sexual behaviors. So rather than letting them mature as virgins and thinking about things they should be thinking about, you want to get them exposed to sex early so they become sexually deranged and disordered. And then they need government services. And then they don't present a political threat to the Jews. The Mosher and Katz study, also sponsored by the commission, clearly supports the proposition that aggression against women increases when that aggression is instrumental to securing sexual stimulation through seeing pornography. The Goldstein study, also financed by the commission, found that rapists were the group reporting the highest, quote, excitation to masturbation, unquote, rates by pornography in the adult, 80%, as well as teen, 90% years. Considering the crime they were imprisoned for, this suggests that pornography, with accompanying masturbation, did not serve adequately as a catharsis, prevent a sex crime, or keep them off the streets. 80% of the rapists reported, quote, wishing to try the act that they had witnessed or seen demonstrated in the pornography exposed to them. So it's given these, essentially, these low-level retards, it gives them ideas, very definitely. It gives the people with the least self-control the most dangerous ideas, is probably what they're saying here. So, the people who argue for pornography say, well, they jerk off instead of raping people, but what Jones and the evidence seem to be saying is, no, it's just going to give them ideas and inspire them. They'll jerk off and then they'll go out and try to do it. And the cops are saying, we don't find people who do these things who don't have this pornography with them. They almost always do, or they always do. 80% of the rapists reported, quote, wishing to try the act that they had witnessed or seen demonstrated in the pornography exposed to them, unquote. When asked if they did in fact follow through with such sexual activity immediately or shortly thereafter, 30% of the rapists said yes. Hill and Link then took the commission to task for studies that it did accept, especially the notorious Kuczynski study, which purported to show that sex crimes decreased in Denmark after the legalization of pornography. The fact is, Hill and Link write in the Minority Report, block quote, that in such a society as modern Copenhagen, where premarital sex and illegitimacy bear no social stigma, where hardcore pornography is sold at every corner kiosk, and the porno or sex shops that dot the city, and at the porno or sex shops that dot the city, so the sex and pornography is very commonly available in Copenhagen. There, where live sex shows are legally conducted and exploited in the daily newspapers, where prostitutes block the sideways and wave from apartment windows. In such a society, I am amazed that any sex crimes are reported. The only reason for a 31% statistical decrease in sex crimes is the fact that what was previously considered a crime is now ignored or legal in Denmark. And finally, the last paragraph of this chapter. Subsequent research into the effects of pornography have confirmed the findings of the Hill Link Minority Report and have at the same time completely discredited the catharsis theory that was the foundation of the majority report. Exposure to pornography does not result in satiation, as the majority satiation, that's hard to pronounce, as the majority report claimed. It may result in satiation to a particular picture or film, but at the same time, the viewer in becoming satiated simply requires a more bizarre form of stimulation to achieve the excitement he previously received with normal pornography, like it's an addiction, like heroin, he's saying. Where you keep, you know, chasing the first high that you got, and you can never get as high, and you have to take more. He's saying pornography is somewhat like that. And so you start with normal pornography, and then you need increasingly extreme pornography involving violence, and ultimately that's why they say the end of the promiscuity is death, or often is. In addition, exposure to pornography creates in the viewer a fundamentally distorted view of sexuality that can lead to assaults on women. In their article, Massive Exposure to Pornography, published in 1984, Zillman and Bryant find that, quote, massive exposure to pornography fosters a general trivialization of rape. It can only be speculated that this effect results from the characteristic portrayal of women in pornography as socially non-discriminating, as hysterically euphoric in response to just about any and every sexual or pseudo-sexual stimulation, and as eager to accommodate any and every sexual request. Such portrayal, it seems, convinces even women of the hyper-promiscuous nature of women. So people who are watching it will think that they're open to everything, and it will distort their understanding of women and actual normally channeled sex. Anyway, that ends that brief chapter, part 3, chapter 15, on page 520. I want to thank you for being with me today. And I'll be back with you for chapter 16 real soon.